I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Cornel West, read Kierkegaard at the age of 13 off the bookmobile in Sacramento, California. And he was struck at once by a kind of terror, a profound sadness and sorrow that struck him as being at the core of the human condition. He's been hooked on philosophy ever since. The modern tradition from Pascal, Kant, Schopenhauer, and Wittgenstein to the Americans John Dewey and William James. He's been hooked, too, on philosophizing in the real-life context of struggle and suffering, especially as it relates to African-Americans. The black quotient in an American philosophy, he says, is a profound sense of the tragic and the comic, rooted in heroic efforts to preserve human dignity on the night side, on the underside of modernity. In short, a deep blue sensibility that highlights concrete existence, history, struggle, lived experience, and joy. This is the concluding week 9 of our summer series on philosophy, and Cornel West, the Alphonse Fletcher University professor at Harvard, is our exemplar of the examined life in flesh and blood in America in our time. What can we learn, Connection listeners, from a practitioner? The Philosophy Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. What can we learn from a life of learning that is also engaged in the Million Man March and teaching in the Bill Bradley campaign for president, among other things? We're talking about what philosophy brings to real life and real life brings to philosophy. Give Cornel West a call at 1-800-423-TALK. And welcome back, Cornel West. I wish you'd just start with your own story, how philosophy came into your life and what you've done with it.
Well, first, let me say it's always a blessing to be here, Chris, and I appreciate, I really congratulate you and staff for taking this on. Now, in my own life, I've always viewed philosophy as first and foremost a calling, not a career, a vocation, not a profession. And what I mean by that is philosophy is not just participating in a philosophical discourse. It's a certain way of life, it's a certain mode of being. It's a certain way of being in the world, and it's frightening, it's terrifying. I mean, Heidegger puts it so well in his magnificent lecture on metaphysics in 1929. Philosophers must reside in the perilous neighborhood of supreme uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And what he means by that is that you have to be willing not just to examine yourself in a Socratic way, but to push yourself through the edge of life's abyss and to recognize the lightness of being, the ways in which we have very little, if any, grounds, foundations, and yet we still must wrestle, grapple, and cope. And that's, for me, what has been the motivation from 13 years old when first reading Kierkegaard. When I read Kierkegaard, he actually he snatched the rug from under me and forced me, kind of threw me into a world of radical uncertainty, a world of absurdity, of darkness, of terror, of sadness, of loneliness, of insecurity. And from there, I had to wrestle, falling back on my sense of tradition, falling back on networks of love, falling back on bonds of compassion, whatever was available, and recognizing that whatever I fell back on itself needed questioning. And so it's a perennial process, and it is an endless journey. And it's been a wonderful one. There's tremendous joy, but there's also tremendous terror and sorrow.
Who's our friend, the poet, who said, you know, she heard J. Alfred Prufrock, and she said, that's my line. That's Jory Graham. That's my business. What was the idea in Kierkegaard that made you say, that's my enterprise, that's my project?
I think it was the stress on the radically historical conditionedness of who we are, which is to say that we're all born under circumstances not of our own choosing, as Marx put it, and that we're all shaped by antecedent realities and the conditionedness of our existence, and at the same time our capacity to shape and reshape, to make and remake our circumstances is what hit me. You know, Jose Ortega y Gasset used to say, it's me plus my circumstances. It's that radical historical character, and that's what I picked up in Kierkegaard. You can get it in Hegel, you can get it in Marx, you can get it in Heidegger, you can get it in Nietzsche. There's a lot of different places that one can one can call this particular insight, but it was Kierkegaard, because he spoke to my sense of being a distinct person in a particular historical moment. And the Danish thinker had that kind of impact on me, really.
What piece of all of us is waiting to be awakened philosophically? I mean, how do each of us kind of liberate that philosophical urge?
Well, I think, one, that we're all shaped by certain traditions that we gain by access to family and nation and community. And I think Emerson is right, that whoso would be a human being must be a nonconformist, and whoso would be a philosophically engaged, a critically engaged human being has to be a nonconformist. We have to be able to see through the superficiality of the surfaces and the mendacity of the world of appearance. And in order to do that, you have to be a nonconformist. You have to get some critical distance from the kinds of teachings, the kind of socializations, the kind of acculturations that we all undergo. And this takes both time, but it most importantly takes courage. I think if there's one virtue associated with philosophical thinking, it is the courage to be. It's the courage to think for oneself. It's the courage to be honest, to have a certain kind of intellectual as well as moral conscience. And all of us fall short in the end, but those who stand out, you know, the Nietzsches and the Wittgensteins and the Heideggers and others, in one sense they make fool of themselves, like Heidegger's Nazism or Wittgenstein's momentary Stalinism. But these are men and women of genius, which is to say there's a geniality that they have, a largeness of mind and soul, because they were willing to push, to question. You know, Heidegger says questioning is the piety of thinking. I would add giving is the piety of living, but that's my own Christian twist. But it's that questioning is the piety of thinking. How deep are we willing to question is a sign of how deep we're willing to think. Just as in the end, how much we're willing to give is a sign of how deep we're willing to live.
For you, what were the sort of questions that involved a kind of departure or rebellion or testing of waters that you hadn't even imagined?
It was suffering. It was massive suffering in the world, the evil, the unmerited pain, and the undeserved harm, which is just so pervasive.
I'm not sure that's what I meant. Your answer may be better than my question, but what I was wondering was simply, in what degree did engaging in philosophy set you forth into new territory, into something, you know? Did it involve this business, the courage to think for yourself and to work it out in your own terms? Where did that take you that, you know, you hadn't been, or that your family hadn't been, or that your boyhood hadn't been?
Oh, yeah, no, it's a good question, because, you see, you keep in mind, I mean, growing up in the black church, wrestling with the book of Ecclesiastes, and wrestling especially with the book of Job, one discovers that one's attempts to be so independent and autonomous and original, you end up, for the most part, rethinking thoughts and recycling notions that have been thought before.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, my God, Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitors already raised the question. Schelling's treatise on human freedom has already wrestled with the question of evil in a way you thought you were wrestling with it in a creative way. It reminds me very much of Norman Mailer's advertisement for myself, where he tries to think new thoughts and doesn't realize that people have thought those thoughts thousands of years before in some ways much more profound manner than he has, even though he's always interesting and provocative. And any serious thinker, I think, reaches that conclusion that, well, I discovered that Montaigne, that Pascal, that Kierkegaard had in fact thought many of my thoughts, had helped me think thoughts that were true to me, and yet in many ways similar to what they already thought. And this is, of course, the crucial role of thinkers who've come before. You recognize there's a certain kind of family that you become a part of persons who have been willing to courageously push themselves to the edge of life's abyss.
Hmm. But how was it that you came back as a Christian, or not necessarily you ever left, but I mean that you came back into belief and a context that you'd also grown up in?
But I came back a different person. That is to say, of course, I'm qualitatively different than the young black brother who grew up in Sunday school in Shiloh Baptist Church. Once you've been through the 47 years that I have, you cannot but be qualitatively different. But you also recognize there were some profound insights there in terms of both the power of love as well as the relative impotence of love, which has so much to do with the cross in Christian discourse. It has something to do with the forms of idolatry. I heard a discourse of idolatry that had to do primarily with either white supremacy or had to do with materialism in America. As you examine, for example, modernity, European modernity, you see new forms of idolatry, of method, of reason, capital R, technique, capital T. These easily become forms of idolatry that valorize science and technology and view them in some kind of salvific fashion, or view them as having the power of deliverance in the face of death and dread and disease and disappointment. You recognize this is not so. Same is true even in certain great poetic works, that poetry itself can become a kind of idolatry, even though the best poetry is critical of itself, as in a Wallace Stevens or in a William Carlos Williams or even a Robert Hayden. So that there are certain insights that you're able to refine and deepen that you learn as a lad, and yet at the same time it's mediated by, one hopes, a certain kind of maturity, a certain kind of exposure and critical reflection to one's experience on the world. So I am very different. I'm a different kind of Christian, of course, than I was 2 years ago. But at the same time, I see great power in the Christian narratives, even though, of course, there's so much barbarity and so many atrocities associated with Christian practices over the last
thousand. You know, the God question is just one of the big issues that we've sort of touched on in this summer series. I wish you could sort of review the whole thing, from the idea of the examined life, questions of justice, questions of love, ethics, free will, science, philosophy of mind. I mean, it's a huge canvas. At the same time, I'd love your thoughts on those thoughts, but I also really want you to help us all, listeners and me, to think philosophically, to pursue this life without ambitions to be a PhD or to or to be a philosopher exactly, to live it. How do we go about it? And how do we particularly get ourselves out of that rut that speaks too lightly of, you know, here's my philosophy on the weather, or here's my philosophy on the National League pennant race, or that kind of vulgarization of the whole idea? How do we do it?
Well, I mean, one is there's a certain kind of commitment that's necessary, a certain kind of conviction that is crucial. You have to be committed to not just thinking critically, but trying to live in such a way that you continually are questioning yourself. And this is a very difficult thing to do, but it's a commitment, and you can't do it all alone. You have to do it with friends. Sometimes those friends may be only your books or your texts. Sometimes those friends are in fact your peers on the job. Everyday people, so-called ordinary people, can be some of the most philosophically refined if they have the courage and if they have the commitment, in the same way that you can be a professor who read and teach these books every year and be the most unphilosophical person in the world because you're not really exerting any kind of courage or taking any risk in terms of how you are thinking, in terms of how you are living. So there's no easy dichotomy to make here between simply those who read and those who don't. I think in the end you're going to be forced to be in conversation with some of the great minds that came before, because their blood, sweat, and tears can be found on those pages.
Name three. And then I want you to sort of identify the kind of question about real life that's philosophical.
Well, I think if you have to begin in the West, at least, with Plato. Plato has been so thoroughly misunderstood. He's associated with certain sophomoric versions of Platonism. But Plato actually is wrestling with, I think, the fundamental question, which you find in Book 10 of 607b5, which is a traditional quarrel of philosophy and poetry. And what we mean here is that if philosophy wrestles with what poets are wrestling with, it means then that issues of death, of dread, of disappointment, of disease, which are the inescapable facts of human existence that force us to deal with finitude and solitude and sadness and loneliness, and thereby generate some sources for a joy, a pleasure, a delight. How do we wrestle with Eros in the face of Thanatos, wrestle with desire in the face of death. I mean, these are the great subject matters of poets and philosophers since, so, 17th century oftentimes have evaded these issues mm-hmm. because we've been so enamored of science, and science is a very important activity in human life. I don't want to downplay it. And the great scientists are dealing, in fact, with issues that poets wrestle with as well. But it's so easy to professionalize the scientific enterprise and thereby to screen oneself and distance oneself from some of these more terrifying issues like death and dread and disappointment. Mm. So when I think you begin with Plato's dialogues, because Plato is a poet who is fearful of poetry becoming predominant and not allowing a place for dialectic, for philosophy. And so you see philosophy and poetry struggling with each other. And here's Plato in the face of the great Homer trying to make place for philosophy. But he himself was a poet even as he's critical of poetry, because he recognizes the power of poetry as well as the limits of poetry. So there's a sense in which, you know, when Whitehead says Western philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato, that's a very profound statement, because it means the generation of this discourse forces us to deal with the most fundamental issues. And of course, the West has its own parochialism. The East and Africa and indigenous peoples are also wrestling with death, dread, disappointment. Mm-hmm. But within the West, these Platonic dialogues, this Socratic Alingus, the great Socrates who never wrote a word but who lived a philosophical life, but who himself was also preoccupied with silence. Socrates is often silent in the most crucial places. Mm-hmm. So you get this fascinating interplay between both language, speech on the one hand, and silence on the other. And of course, the silence of Socrates not writing a word, and Plato, his disciple, trying to make the world safe for Socrates, and thereby generating this unbelievable set of dialogues that we've been wrestling with ever since.
Connection listeners, it's week 9, the 9th inning in our summer game of philosophy. Cornel West of Harvard is our guide to the examined life, the philosophical life. You don't have to be a philosopher, and not all philosophers live philosophical lives, he points out. But it is a discipline. It is a challenge. It's difficult. He says it's frightening. He says it takes courage. How do you do it? 1-800-423-8255. How do you want to do it? 1-800-423-TALK is the Philosophy Connection phone. Roger is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Roger. Welcome.
Welcome. Good to be on the radio with you. I find in my life's thinking, my life's journey, a useful distinction between the African-American Christian point of view that emphasizes relational, communal thinking, communal action, how do we relate to others, rather than the traditional European rational point of view, which tends to be individualistic and points to thinking. In other words, I look to how do we establish right relationships? How do we broaden our relationships? How do we establish positive relationships to other people and to other things?
I relate, therefore I am, so to speak.
That's it. That's it. And how to strengthen and make those relationships more positive and stronger, rather than the right thinking, which can be rather individualistic.
I think it's an interesting question, and it resonates with criticisms that people have made of this series, that we're too analytical, rational. Some of these criticisms I don't entirely understand, Cornel West, but guide us. And do you take the mantle of the sort of African-American Christian relational communal bent on things?
Well, I mean, one, I think we recognize that none of these traditions are monolithic or homogeneous. I mean, I think, for example, of the very rich legacy of Jerusalem that takes us back to the Hebrew Bible, where I-thou relations are very important. Martin Buber's text on I-thou is probably one of the great classics on dealing with relationality rooted in Hebraic Judaic tradition. Creatively appropriated by Buber, but still that particular tradition. The same is true in the New Testament, where it's very much a relational. It's a love relation, but it's still relational. One is because one relates to the other in a certain kind of way. And this is one of the reasons why so many contemporary thinkers these days, be they Christian or non-Christian, Jewish or non-Christian, Jewish or non-Jewish, are concerned about the legacy of the work of Emmanuel Levinas, who's very much concerned with the relation of the I and the thou and the responsibility for the other. So that this is both Western, but it's still very relational. Now, of course, the Black Christian view is one that is part of the legacy of Jerusalem, but it's also rooted in the experience of Black subjugation and Black oppression in the United States. Now, when we talk about individualism, we're talking about something very modern, it's modern European and modern American, of course. America's born modern. And it has its virtues, because you do want to be able to liberate the individual from his or her family, community, tradition that is suffocating them, that is in a variety of different ways suppressing them. But on the other hand, this idea of individuals being by themselves, isolated, distant from community is a certain another kind of trap. It's another pit, as it were. And part of the wrestling with modernity and the legacy of Jerusalem and Athens is to try to create some kind of balance between this rich individuality that we all want and the inescapability of community, which we all need.
Roger, good question, and thank you. 1-800-423-8255, The Examined Life with Cornel West. Marge is on the line.
Am I on? This is
Marge. You are, Marge. Thanks for calling.
Okay. I live this philosophical life, I think, through honesty, and I think that it is something that is very dangerous and very risky these days, because it's hard to be totally objective, even in my subjectivity. I mean, because I know that I am circumstanced, and my circumstances have a whole lot to do with who I am. But finally, I have to stand back and even critique myself in terms of my circumstance, in terms of my religion. I have to critique that religion. I'm an African-American fundamentalist, if you will, and that that community has been good to me, and it has secured me. But finally, I even have to stand back and critique even that, and it puts me at risk of sort of severing myself from my community. But I think that it is terribly difficult to be honest in these days when we are so filled with mass media and we're supposed to be in relation. We're supposed to, you know, finally be whoever we are. We're supposed to be Black. We're supposed to be Christian. We're supposed to be, but there may be times when these traditions are probably not moving us in the right direction.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it's very, very difficult to be honest. And I'd like to ask Professor West what he's, you know, how he can help us be more honest, you know, how to sort of critique our own hearts finally.
Yeah, that's a very profound question. I mean, I think that it's not honesty in and of itself. It's also the spirit behind the honesty. Some people are honest but very cruel in their honesty, and therefore it gives honesty a bad name. There has to be some compassion behind the honesty so people can see that the honesty is inseparable from being empowered, from being in some way enabled and ennobled. Part of the problem these days in our market-driven culture, which is shot through with so much dishonesty and mendacity and falsity, is that honesty is associated with being a loser. And of course, American culture evolves around winning. It's all about success. And people are free to what? Succeed. And you succeed by any means. And if it's dishonest means, so what? So when honesty is associated with being a loser, and there's no space in American culture for losers, such as you could imagine what Jesus would be in this culture. My God, he'd be on the corner right in front of Arlington Church, homeless. Thank God for Arlington Church's ministry. But my God, he'd be a loser, capital L. And so honesty has to be associated with a certain kind of empowerment, but also a willingness to lose and fail, though in the end it might be a greater winning, even though you're ostracized by a community owing to your honesty.
Marge?
I really appreciate that answer, but and I agree with it. In a competitive society, how do we deal with competition? That's sort of the goal, you know. We have to be competitive. You can't even have a sister, you know, without competing with one another. And it's so ingrained in us. How do we handle it? I'll take the answer off the air.
Yeah, Marge, thank you.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, we've got to be able to cooperate before we compete. I mean, I think certainly we have to survive, and therefore we end up in some way competing for a job or profession. But Without cooperation in our lives, we end up competing without really living, or we end up really going through the motions of our careers without really going through any substantive meaning in our lives. And I think this balance of cooperation and competition is a very, very crucial one. But you're right. I mean, the whole culture is just bent on this this race for material toys, this race for visibility, this race for attention, this race for status and so on.
I like your thought on honesty, and I hope it's what Marge had in mind. What is this, the drive to be honest? I'm not quite sure how that becomes, you know, there's so many things to be honest about. Sometimes in a lot of human relations, particularly you say honesty with cruelty in intimate relations is a devastating thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you have to have a wisdom. I mean, philosophy in the end is a quest for wisdom, and you have to be wise in your quest for honesty. And wisdom has to do with a certain kind of compassion, a certain kind of prudence, a certain kind of power of discernment and insight. And that's not reducible simply to knowledge and fact-finding.
Professor Cornel West is leading our quest in this ninth week of our summer series on philosophy. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour...
It's week 9 of our philosophy series. Professor Cornel West, prolific writer, lecturer, three-dimensional, real-life philosopher, is our guest. And he's talking about the examined life as it's come to him. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. Professor West, this is week 9 of our summer series. One of the subjects we talked about and didn't was what you people call the problem of evil. You've written a lot about it. Can you give us the short course?
Well, I mean, the problem of evil traditionally has to do with how do you reconcile a good God with a world of misery, a God that is omniscient on the one hand and benevolent on the other, and yet at the same time we've got all of this suffering and misery in the world. It goes back to stories about the creation of the world. Was creation good? If it was good, then what was the nature of the fall? Or is evil in the Godhead itself, as Schelling suggested in 1809 in his treatise? Gnostics arguing, of course, that in fact maybe there's an evil God at work. Or the many Manichaeans arguing you've got forces of good on the one hand and forces of evil on the other, forces of light on the one hand, forces of darkness on the other. It's a profound question. I don't think that it can be philosophically resolved. I think in the end, it's really about how do we perennially wrestle with the question, yet also try to become more caring and mature and loving and sacrificial, risk-taking human beings. Because I think evil is something that is inescapable. Anybody who's thrown into this world can see the deep levels of injustice. There's no doubt about it. Even in the year 2000, look at the AIDS epidemic in Africa. Look at the level of poverty. What is it? Really, one half of those on the globe make less than $2 a day. The top three individuals have more wealth than the bottom 48 countries. This is a kind of cosmic injustice as well as a historical injustice. It has to do with the way our economy is structured, the way our nation states function. Also, there is something called the cruelties of fate and the furies of destiny. Why is it that someone loses a life in a car accident? Why is it that someone else gets cancer at 5, cancer at 15, and so on? There's levels of injustice that are simply overwhelming, and a philosophically engaged person, which is to say an everyday person who's concerned about living a certain kind of philosophic life, cannot but be deeply bothered by these questions. This is one of the reasons why Arthur Schopenhauer is such a powerful figure for me. I think his resolutions are thoroughly unconvincing in terms of trying to deny the will and lose a sense of individuality.
How does he resolve it?
He opts for a kind of aesthetic saintlyhood in which persons deny the will to live and become contemplative. He associates art itself with a certain kind of contemplation that holds at arm's length the world of striving, which he connects to the suffering, the inescapable suffering. And though he argued it was better not to have been born at all, if you're born, it's better somehow to, in the end, become contemplative, become aesthetic. In fact, he even argued that voluntary starvation through death is a certain kind of sublime way of being in the world, because the world itself is so evil. Well, you see, I think his wrestling with the darkness of the world is quite powerful. I think Schopenhauer is one of the great figures of modern European philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's just in the end, I think that I'm much more tied to history, much more tied to individuality, the very things that he wants to escape from. Mm-hmm. So I can learn much from his wrestling, even though I, again, disagree with his conclusions, as it were. But that's true for most folks. You don't want to, in any way, end up agreeing with the philosopher's conclusion. They have to work it out for themselves. You must work it out for yourself. Emerson says imitation is suicide, and he's absolutely right.
Connection listeners, be warned. This is not about imitation. It's about seeing an example, though, in Cornel West of the philosophical life. 1-800-423-8255. We're learning how to live philosophically by example this hour with Cornel West. Brian is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Brian. Welcome.
Hi. How you doing? I just want to say first that it's a great, great pleasure to hear Dr. West on the radio. My brother, who just graduated from Harvard Law School in June, was an avid pupil of Dr. West. So,
aren't we all?
Well, and, your brother's name is?
Matthew.
Oh, Brother Matthew. Indeed, indeed.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant brother.
My brother's in New York now. He just took the bar, and he's taking a few weeks off to relax.
Is that right? I know he lost his father and was wrestling with that, and God bless him, be with him. Though he's a dynamite and brilliant human being.
Yeah, he is wonderful. We lost our father in December. Yeah.
But, both of y'all stay strong, though, brother.
Thank you very much, brother.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to call because I'm 29 years old. I've just gone back to school after 10 years of being in the workforce, and I'm studying sociology communications. A friend of mine just happens to have done the same thing after 6 years of being in high finance, went back to pursue a PhD in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm African American. My friend is white. A great friend of mine, and we spent the weekend together, and we had a lot of discussions over the weekend regarding philosophy. And it occurs to me that there's a huge gap in what seems to be a philosopher's pursuit and what we can actually apply in an everyday social context.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me from our conversations that two things, that the study of philosophy, at least when it's discussed from my point of view infrequently, but no less so than the average person, seems to be dominated by a European Greco-Roman culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it also occurs to me that a lot of philosophers probably had the luxury of sitting around and pontificating a lot.
Oh, that's true.
Whereas a lot of the people living at the time and today do not have that luxury.
Absolutely.
So I'm wondering about the social context of where these philosophies come from. How applicable are they today? Because one thing that we argued about all weekend long was affirmative action. And when I tried to invoke statistics of the disproportionalism of African Americans in this country in terms of social justice, his response simply was, racism is wrong either way, which I do agree with, but when you look at the proportionality of it, we have to make fundamental options that determine policies. And so how does philosophy, it seems as though sometimes it is invoked by people as almost a weapon of adhering to absolute virtue, when in fact, in our society, we don't have an absolute level playing field. And I would like Dr. West to comment on that.
Brian, thank you.
Absolutely. No, and those are very tough questions. I mean, one is you have to begin with the racist past in the country, the ways in which the criminal justice system is still so deeply racist. Racism against anybody, of course, is wrong. But when you have a history of white supremacy that has had such tremendous weight and gravity in America's past and present, look at the criminal justice system, look at the level of child poverty, look at the what America's willing to permit and condone when it comes to black suffering as opposed to other people's suffering, with the exception of indigenous people's suffering. It's fairly clear that racism is not some moral abstraction, or condemnation of racism is not some kind of moral gesture. You have to understand the historical and political and economic content of racism. And that's one of the problems that we've always had in America. Most Americans, as we've noted on this show many times before, would rather evade that issue to get very sentimental. It's nice to have a black here or there included, but really don't want to talk about 244 years of slavery, 81 years of Jim Crow, and the ways in which that legacy is still alive. And so that's part of the challenge. Part of the philosophical life is to say, look, individuals engage in self-examination. Let's have nations engage in self-examination. And in the end, let's be part of humanity. I mean, I think in many ways that nationalism itself is a form of idolatry. I think it's a form of tribalism. I think that too many Americans really believe that American life is more precious than the life of an Iranian, of a Kurd, of a Jew, of an Israeli, and so forth and so on, you see. And I think that that's a certain kind of narrowness, to put it charitably, a blindness, as it were. But those who are critically examining themselves end up critically examining their nation and their world. And you can't examine America without coming to terms with this racist past that has unbelievable consequences to this very moment in this country.
Hmm. Brian, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The Examined Life connection with Professor Cornel West. Jack is on the line.
Yeah, hi, Chris. How
Welcome,
are you?
Jack.
Can
Good.
You hear me well?
Yes.
I just want to share a couple of observations. I've been a philosophical kind of person most of my life. I came out of working class Boston, basically. I grew up in Roxbury, Jamaica Plain. Did everything kind of the hard way in the sense of evening school and so forth. And I'm kind of looking back on it now as I'm in my 50s. But there were two things that really came out of my experiences as I raised my kids. And one of them goes back to Augustine, St. Augustine. I'm kind of putting things real quick here. And he made the comment, faith is believing what you can't see. The reward of faith is to see what you believe. And I've always found as these things kind of complicate themselves as I grew up and had friends that got sick and, of course, gone through deaths in my own family and disappointments as they affected my life.
Mm-hmm.
I always found that was a marvelous, marvelous kind of concept that if I just kept the faith, if I put my nose to the grindstone, if I just did the things, the reward of faith, and I've seen some phenomenal things, a strong marriage, we've been through good times and bad times, I saw my kids graduate from top schools,
mm-hmm.
So it's just been a marvelous, marvelous trip. The other was while I was going to evening school over in Boston College, and that's the way I went to school. It took me 7 years, but I did get a degree. I ran into a young scholastic one time, and we got into a concept of the way he was living his life. And we got on to some of the vows that he had taken, particularly as the element of chastity, obedience, poverty, and so on and so forth. And he made the comment to me, he said, I'm going to throw seven words at you. Seven words. I think there were seven of them. And those seven words, he said, you could make a whole philosophy of life. And, you know, I thought about it.
What kind of words, Jack?
You don't miss.
I say, what kind of words are we talking about?
Oh, he made the comment, these seven words were, you don't miss what you can't have. And if you really think about that, you know, you could just, you can have a pretty decent and honest and honorable life and kind of go through a very, very complicated world, never solving the issues of death and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, if poor Bill Clinton understood that concept, you know, he wouldn't have seen the world as the big candy store he thought it was.
And Professor West?
Well, I appreciate the word. I mean, one, just the praise of Augustine, I think, is appropriate. Augustine has his own dark sides and limitations, but he's a towering figure. The North African theologian is one of the great philosophers and theologians from whom we can learn so much. But I do want to raise a question about the second. I think, for example, of Dante's relation to Beatrice. He certainly missed what he couldn't have, and it led towards some of the greatest poetry in the Italian language, and even in the Latin language as well. That is to say, and same would be true for Leopardi's Three Affairs, that he wished he had. He missed it greatly and ended up writing some of the greatest lyrical poetry in the Italian language. So there's a sense in which you do miss what you can't have, and you sublimate it at times and go on to do other things. You redirect your energy, as it were. But generally speaking, the remark about Augustine, I would concur with, and I'd recommend Brother Gary Wills' recent book on Augustine, as well as the classic by Peter Brown, Augustine of Hippo.
Hmm. Jack, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, The Philosophical Life, a guide by Professor Cornel West. Richard is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Richard.
Oh, thank you very much. An amazing show today, and the whole series has been quite wonderful. Professor West, I wanted to ask you a question that sort of pulls off from your comment earlier on about the issue of the problem of evil and its effects, and especially how it concerns to the factual situation that I've just put myself in moving, where I entered into a situation which is marred by the effects of evil among young people in the inner city.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of alienation.
Absolutely.
A lot of fear. A lot of mistrust and suspicion.
That's right.
And it's something that makes you tap into to that fear that the only way you sort of have to tap into that fear yourself. Mm-hmm. If not, you sort of wind up just writing off these fellows who, you know, for all intents and purposes, are probably wonderful people and such. Just this veneer of intimidation and mistrust.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been one of those experiences that. That truly has sort of that has turned my world around again,
yes,
and it's
yes.
launched me into a round of questioning that in the last 4 years of me as a student of philosophy has intensified the tension, and more so than any than encountering any writer has.
What's the question here you're dealing with for the first time, Richard?
I think the question is one of. Of how deeply embedded racism and fear can affect the viewpoint.
Absolutely.
Professor West.
And I think it makes the point again that so much of genuine philosophizing comes from lived experience. It comes from life itself. It's not just a matter of the text. It's impossible to understand Montaigne's wisdom without understanding house arrest twice, civil wars in France, observation of carnage, of massive killing, and so forth. It's impossible to understand Hobbes's Leviathan without understanding English Civil War. I used to talk with John Rawls, of course, the towering figure, the last great liberal political theorist, and my friend and teacher and brother, and he used to tell me that a theory of justice, which seems in the eyes of so many readers abstract, distant, was rooted in his profound fear of religious intolerance, a religious persecution from his readings of history and his own development as a child and so forth, so that these lived experiences are inescapable. And now we need more than that. We need reflection. We need text. But the lived experience was very, very real. And what I hear this brother saying is living in inner city.
Yeah, but point him as a next step. He's had this radicalizing experience of intimidation and fear. Then what? How do you channel that into something other than just depression or anxiety or flight?
Oh, I mean, I think he's already on the road, that he sees a certain kind of hope. That is to say, he's already empathized. He's already tried to put himself in the skin of other persons so that he can understand their circumstances, what they're up against. And once you do that, you've already begun to humanize. So you're not demonizing. And once you humanize, you see that there's possibility. Now, the possibility is always circumscribed by a certain set of alternatives and options. But as long as you see possibility, I mean, that's what faith is, having the courage to step out and affirm possibility in the face of uncertainty. And I see that kind of courage in his in his words, and I can feel it in his spirit, actually.
Richard, keep doing it. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The Philosophy Connection, Week 9, with Professor Cornel West. Jeff is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Jeff. Welcome.
Hi. I wanted to say, first of all, thank you to both of you, Chris, for always putting on such great programs, and Professor West for being generally just a sharp and inspirational thinker.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
You're welcome. I wanted to ask a question about democratic socialism and doing politics in a philosophical way. I know,
yes.
Professor West, you identify yourself as a democratic socialist or a radical Democrat.
That's right.
And I would identify myself the same way. I've been involved in those kinds of politics. And my gut feeling, and I suppose a lot of people would disagree with this, but my gut feeling is that most, or at least very, very many Americans, don't so much disagree substantively with the ideas that democratic socialists support, ideas like economic equality and a more participatory democracy, ideas of solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
My gut feeling is that one of the hugest problems why democratic socialist politics has such a hard time getting near the mainstream of politics in our country is that it means thinking about talking about democratic socialism means talking about politics in a philosophical way, talking about politics in a way that raises big questions and expects big answers.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's just a hard thing to do practically, a hard thing to be both doing political activism in a way that matters here and now, and asking those huge questions about systemic social change, to be both, you know, to being both, as your friend Mike Harrington would have said, being both visionary and gradualist at the same time.
Yes, no, I think you're on to some. I would say there's two basic reasons. One is that we Americans, we love to be experimental about nearly everything other than our basic social structure. And there we're rather dogmatic. And I think the reason why we're dogmatic is that the formation of industrial America was predicated on a sacred cow, which is corporate power. Corporate power, or the corporate priorities in the economy, became the precondition for American life, American politics, American culture. I mean, one of the reasons why I think Ralph Nader's campaign is so very important. I'm going to Los Angeles just in a couple of days, and I'm going to be pushing Brother Ralph Nader, because he's not perfect, but he understands if we cannot somehow expose the sacred cow, the oligarchs, the plutocrats, in some ways the pigmentocrats, the corporate elites, who serve in some ways the way the kings and the queens did before liberals came along. Because we in Americans believe that our economy can flow only when corporate priorities are put forward. And this is true for Gore, it's true for Lieberman, it's true for Bush, it's true for Cheney.
What is this thing in our politics, this fear of the vision thing? John Kennedy in my youth was had a philosophical presence about him. We know now in hindsight he was close to death all the time. He was, I mean, he said pregnant things like life is unfair. He had a reflective mind. How would we restore that our civic life?
I mean, you remember Profiles in Courage. He was a kind of intellectual. Now, he did not question the sacred cow.
True.
Because he ran for office.
He was the son of one, yeah.
Absolutely. And very few do. Bernie Sanders does, and, of course, Ron Dellums did. There's a few elected officials, but very few, because the political system filters our candidates in such a way that they're already being shaped by this ideology of corporate priorities in the economy before they even run. They need their money, they need their support, and so forth. But John Kennedy was a very reflective figure, and we haven't had a figure like that probably since Woodrow Wilson, who was also an intellectual, a very important one, also very racist, but a very significant intellectual. It's very difficult for intellectuals to surface in American political life because intellectual life is associated with a certain kind of elitism, a certain kind of condescension, a certain kind of haughtiness and arrogance. And good Democrats are always critical of any form of arrogance, including myself. But I believe that intellectual life can be rendered compatible with democratic sensibilities, even though the intellectual life is for the highly disciplined. And that means then the nonconformists, the highly disciplined, that end up creating a kind of elite, but it's an elite that's open to anybody. And part of the problem in America is we're so obsessed with money making, who has time to be highly disciplined about the life and the mind? That's tremendous commitment and conviction required to do that.
And yet we hear it every day on The Connection, and we've certainly heard it in this philosophy series, a kind of and we hear it at this hour, a tremendously eager, democratic readiness to open themselves, even to take big chances, to talk back.
That's true. That's very true.
I think these people, seriously, I
that keeps the flame alive, as it were. But
it
but
does, and it also follows your example.
Alive.
I think it's very...
Well, I think it follows your example. I mean, because again, we get back to Plato,
well,
it's all about
you.
Dialogue. It's all about dialogue, and it's about a certain kind of respect, a certain kind of acknowledgement that we all can make fools of ourselves. We're all on the ever-moving ship of fools, forced in the end to join the undignified dance of death, and hope that we would live such a life that others will be willing to fight for justice, for democracy, as they join the undignified dance of life.
Keep leading the way. Professor Cornel West, it's a tremendous pleasure and privilege always to have you on The Connection, and thank you for sort of wrapping up our summer philosophy series. Now what are we going to do for an encore? But in the meantime, Connection listeners, you can listen to all 9 hours online, and you can continue the philosophical conversation on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. Thank you, Cornel West. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Conexant Systems in Westboro, accepting resumes at careers@conexant.com. Conexant, what's next in communications technologies? By Swiss Air, offering a new second direct flight to Zurich from Logan with a late evening departure on its new A330.